You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
I am really excited today because we get to launch a new series.
Yes.
With our favorite musicologist.
It's true.
Because he wrote a book.
He did.
And this is exciting stuff. We're going to talk about Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music, 1847 to 1947, with Benjamin Kolodgy in just a moment. Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University Chicago. You can learn more about Concordia University Chicago by visiting cuchicago.edu. And speaking of Concordia University Chicago, we get to go back in some of their history today. There's an intersection today of Concordia University Chicago and some of the history we'll be talking about, which is so exciting.
Yes.
Joining us today, Benjamin Kolodgy. He's church organist and a musicologist, and he has written Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music, 1847 to 1947, available from Concordia Publishing House, and it's available today, and we get to talk about it today. Benjamin, welcome back to the Coffee Hour.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me, Andy and Sarah.
It wasn't that long ago that we got to chat for Bach Week and talk about liturgical life in the time of Bach. And so we're going to move forward in history a little bit. Just a little time. So we talked about Bach last time. Now we're going to move forward to Lutherans a little bit later in history and taking a look at your book, Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music. So today we want to talk about why sacred music has been important to the Lutheran Church throughout history. But we're going to take a look at closer, a few hundred years later. 1847 is where we're, around that time is where we're going to pick up. So share with us why you think sacred music has been important to the Lutheran Church.
Well, it was important for Luther. Luther saw the music tradition in the Catholic Church. And unlike the other reformers like Zwingli or Calvin, who greatly reduced or completely omitted sacred music or art, Luther saw the value in that. And he repristinated the greatest treasures in the Catholic Church and changed them so that they were focusing on law and gospel and presented things clearly in a way that people could understand. But that was important for him. And it was also important that sacred music be taught, and hence the development of the cantor position, the teacher, the director of music, you might say, for modern times. So how do you teach sacred music? How do you promote something to your children? That's a bit about some of what I talk about in my book.
What did that look like at the time of, well, I guess, Luther, and maybe how did that shift and change, or maybe not shift and change, up until the time that we're talking about today, 1847?
Well, let's talk about pedagogy. And that's a big word, but I know you've had it on your show before. We talk about that in terms of classical education these days. But pedagogy just means, you know, learning how to teach, or conversely, learning how do you learn? And so this is important in teaching the faith. Let's look back at Bach that we talked about, had Bach Week recently. Bach was the foremost cantor and teacher. Although he composed all this music, most of his day was spent teaching Latin, teaching boys in the school. So there has always been a component of teaching in the Lutheran Church. So I kind of wanted to start there, but then go to where I start, which is American Lutheranism. And it starts off very rough. It's not demarcated very well in terms of the LCMS. And that's why I start my book in essentially 1847. But the first fellow in my book, his name is Ferdinand Winter. And nobody knew much about him. Arguably, you can say we don't know much about him still, but I've researched and found about as much as can be found out. But his story kind of elucidates early LCMS education, pedagogy, the development of sacred music and the cantorate. He was born in 1817. He was trained as a teacher, but teachers were trained as musicians too. He learned how to play organ, piano, violin, basic choral techniques. But as with most things in the early 19th century in Germany and Prussia, they were complicated by the Prussian Union, which the king had said that essentially, the liturgy and preaching had to be a combination of Lutheran and Reformed, and it became watered down. And Winter and his contingent of faithful Lutherans, they wanted to teach from the Bible, they wanted to teach to the catechism, and they wanted to teach the hymnal. Those were their three main pedagogical books, and that became increasingly difficult. So Winter himself actually came with the first LCMS Lutherans. Of course, they weren't LCMS at the time. This was 1838, 1839 that they came over. And Winter came and settled in Altenburg, Missouri, which you may know, of course, for the Altenburg debate. That's where the Log Cabin College was that C.F.W. Walter had kind of established. And he taught there. He taught school, taught sacred music. And you can still visit where he was at the Lutheran Heritage Museum in Altenburg. But I want to read a bit about what Winter presented his education. So this is a quotation. He exhibited trademarks of a classic confessional Lutheran educator. His curriculum was typical of the early Saxon schools. His first concern was a thorough and intense catechetical training aimed at molding the children to fit a confessional Lutheran mindset. As textbooks and other teaching resources were scarce in the early Missouri Synod, the curriculum was adapted to fit what the teacher had on hand, the only common textbooks being Luther's Small Catechism, the Hymnal, and the Bible. So Winter's catechetical instruction was based almost entirely on the Small Catechism, using as his core text. And a significant part of his curriculum was centered around the old Lutheran chorales. So the chorales were used both in Germany, in Prussia, Saxony, and in the United States to teach. And so he was what we consider, he lived till the 1860s, so his life intersected with the founding of the LCMS in 1847. Ferdinand Winter was about the first cantor teacher in the Missouri Synod.
Where did much of his teaching take place? You mentioned that he taught in Altenburg, Missouri. Did it stay there or did he go elsewhere as well?
Basically, it did. It stayed there. And I called my book The Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music because I endeavored to find portraits of everybody. But Winter was the only fellow for whom I could not find a portrait. I spent some good time over at the museum in Altenburg. The people there are very helpful. But they could not find a picture of him either. And that just shows that he spent his whole time in his school building. It was apparently very primitive. There were snakes falling from the ceilings. I mean, it was very rugged. And so he probably never had a picture made of him. It shows you his influence did not expand much beyond Altenburg. But I want to read what his pastor said about him after he died. His pastor wrote, "I conclude this from the fact that he never made a big deal about it, as it was precisely the full pots that sound the least. When he was on the organ bench, he played with such zeal that the sweat ran down his forehead. He knew how to elicit beautiful harmonies from the organ, as no one else could easily do. In short, even though I little understood the heavenly art of organ playing, I always knew it immediately when he was at the organ, even if I could not see him." So even though Winter did not have great influence on the synod, he represents the musical tradition that came from Germany and that soon would be important as musicians were trained.
What was the reach of his influence then? How did training for church musicians develop then if he stayed there in Altenburg? How did we end up with more church musicians?
Exactly. And that takes us to 1864. Then that is the year that the Addison Seminary was founded. Addison is a little village south of Chicago, still there. But as the synod grew, the idea was that each congregation would establish its own school. And in many cases, the pastor was the teacher at the school. And obviously, you can see many problems with that, pastor being overextended with his other duties. So there was established in 1864 the Addison Seminary. And we mustn't think of it in the seminary as a modern sense, but a seminary in terms of teaching boys and men, because that's who it was, mostly for the teaching profession. Some of them, this was like a boarding school. So you could go at confirmation age around 14, and you could stay essentially, 18 through 20. You'd go through your We would call it now maybe an associate's degree. But you could go for perhaps 6 years boarding school. You'd learn how to be a Lutheran teacher. You could then go on, and many fellows did become ordained after that, or you just stayed as a teacher. So as the synod grew, as these congregations multiplied, there was a need for all of these teachers. So the Addison Seminary was founded. And what I really like about this is pastors were called pastors, right? Reverend. But teachers are called, they're addressed as teacher. Teacher Bates or Teacher Golseth. You know, that shows the reverence and the respect for the profession. Not so much the person, but the profession. So the teacher was a highly respected profession. Incumbent within this teaching profession was sacred music. They had to learn piano, organ, violin, and the basics of singing. So the curriculum at Addison involved much music. In fact, the third faculty member, his name is Carl Brower, and I cover him in one of my chapters in my book. He was the first full-time music professor in the LCMS, which sounds a lot more auspicious than it actually was. But what this shows is that music was so important that already the third faculty member had to be devoted essentially full-time to teaching the students music. And in his free time, he managed to produce a chorale book. A chorale book is an accompaniment book for organists. And I think it's important to realize why he did this. And he wrote this in the preface. He says, quote, "In order to promote church hymnody, it is necessary that artful cantors and organists employ the appropriate tunes in the manner in which they have established themselves over many years. For this purpose, it is necessary to have as complete a collection as possible in the hands of those who would learn, which they can later employ in the service of their own congregations." So prior to this, the hymnal only had words. There's only text. And the organist had to be responsible for finding the music. Well, you know, there wasn't a lot of resources and no telling where they would find those resources. So Brower wanted to establish something that organists could play. Organists from Addison, which would then be sent throughout the LCMS. So they could all play the same thing and then the people would sing the same thing. And he said following, I'm going to this quotation too, quote, "If the congregation is to learn to sing, it must always hear the same melody and harmony. And if a member of the congregation from Baltimore or Omaha is to sing properly and without offense in a Lutheran congregation in Chicago, the organists in Baltimore, Chicago, and Omaha must present the chorales the same way, with one melody, one rhythm, and one harmony. Otherwise, confusion will result." Now, I don't think that Brower would have approved of my organ playing, so I just say that. But what he was trying to do is establish his students throughout the nation that they would play the same way, that they would be, you could sing easily to them and they would be able to teach the congregation to sing the great chorales.
We're talking with Benjamin Clogy, church organist and musicologist. We have a new series on his book, Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music, 1847 to 1947. We have just started, so we, of course, have a lot more to cover right after we take a quick break. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago. I'm thrilled to announce the Prepared to Serve Church Professional Guarantee. Any new student in one of CUC's six church work programs will pay no more than $5,000 in annual tuition and required fees guaranteed. Prepared to Serve is a donor-funded initiative. Support future church work students by becoming a funding partner at cuchicago.edu/preparedtoserve. Concordia University Chicago. With Christ at the center, we stand tall for the church.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with Benjamin Clogy, church organist and musicologist, on his book in our new series, Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music, 1847 to 1947, available today from CPH. It's very exciting. We'll put the link to the book in our show notes. And before we went to break, you were telling us some of the history and the music and some really interesting information about Addison Seminary. Tell us more about this history of the seminary and how the seminary influenced the development, the further development of church music and teaching church music in the synod.
Sure. And I think maybe we could consider a week in the life of a Lutheran school teacher. So they had 5 days of teaching. Obviously, they would also teach their children chorales. And this was kind of the choir of the 19th century Lutheran church. They didn't have standalone choirs like we have now. They taught their children. It was a very good way to teach everybody hymnody, really. So the teacher would teach for 5 days, in which music was an important component of that. And I'm going to refer to him as he, because the teachers were men in these early days. But then on Saturday, this was the fun part. They'd probably be boarding with a congregation member, or they'd have pretty primitive accommodations. But on Saturday, they could spend that time in the church so they could prepare for Sunday morning. So the organist for Sunday morning, the Addison Seminary would teach this. You had to choose your hymn. You had to choose your hymn tunes. By some accounts, the pastors would leave the hymns, hopefully by Saturday morning, in the vestry or the sacristy. And it was up to the organist to find those hymns, choose a tune, maybe use a tune from Brouwer's chorale book, if the teacher knew it from Addison, and then prepare. He would have to prepare interludes on the organ. Maybe it was a pump organ. Many churches did not have pipe organs at the time. Maybe it was just piano. Many of them early on had to play violin, so they would lead the singing just with violin and with their voice. So they would have to determine all of this service music on Saturday. And hopefully by maybe 5 or 6 o'clock, the cantor would be free to go out on the town or something. But then he'd be back on Sundays, and he is responsible for all the music, with maybe his school choir would sing. But regardless, he'd have to play the organ. So I really think that I quite admired these teachers. The more I read the stories about them and their own accounts, they really had to be well-rounded musicians. Pastors were generally trained in music too, remember? So if you went to the Addison Seminary, you could become a pastor too. So they would often have this musical training, but the full-time teacher musician had to go further. He really had to be proficient in his piano, organ, violin, and singing. So this was a really busy life. And the teacher's vocation was really viewed as an extension of the office of the word. He assisted the pastor in teaching confirmation. You know, I talked about the catechism being such an important textbook. So he assisted the pastor doing that. There was barely had a day off. And so I really quite admire these early Addison graduates in their work ethic and their faithfulness to teaching.
I'm intrigued by something you mentioned that I think is quite different than how congregations sing hymnody today. And that was that you mentioned that the cantor would choose the tune for the hymn each week for the hymns that we're pretty used to. I think most congregations are pretty used to singing the tune that is printed with the text in our hymnals. I want to unpack this a little bit more. Where did that change? Where did that change from the cantor choosing a tune to us having printed hymnals and typically one standard tune for each hymn? Or I mean that I guess the you might have a tune that's used for multiple hymns, but that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I do unpack some of that in my book, and it depends on what you're talking about, because hymnals had of all theological traditions. So we're talking Anglican, only had text. Now, this was not always true uniformly through history, because we know that early Reformation, there was music associated with some of these texts. But as things develop, you know, if you look at John Newton's only hymn, say, from the 19th century, English language hymnal, just text. You could look at them as poetry. And the Lutherans in America had this same tradition when the first hymnal was published in 1847, words only. And so you had a tune name at a top, which the organist could use. But the problem is, I kind of think that congregations didn't know as many hymn tunes as we sometimes think they did back in an ideal era, like the 19th century, you know, when we were all good Lutherans and we all sang a lot of hymns. I don't think that they actually knew as many tunes as some of our really astute congregations now know. So, because I found references to congregations only knowing, you know, a dozen or two dozen hymn tunes. So this would be problematic for the organist. You'd have to choose a tune, not necessarily the one that it said to use. You'd have to use one that your congregation knew. So it really wasn't until the 20th century with there's a hymnal published in 1912. And certainly we know that TLH 1941 has the tunes and the text with it. By that time, it's very familiar. But well through into the early 20th century, congregations sang from hymns text only. And that created a lot of problems. But that was one of the things that the organist just had to deal with on Saturday.
And I suppose the matching of text and tune would be, I mean, it's not, you have to pay attention to meter and like syllables and words. This would be a process for those church musicians.
And that is one of the things that they taught at the Addison Seminary. The accent, the meter. If you look in the back of LSB, you see the metrical index. And if you find a meter, or you find the hymn tune given by shows the meter, and whatever meter that is, you know, those tunes will be interchangeable for that meter. But all of that had to be taught. And actually, Walter's hymnal had a very complicated metrical index, which allowed you to do this. It's complicated to us now. It was actually very easy to them because they knew how to do this. It was taught at Addison. But it was really important. This also, we'll talk a bit later about C.F.W. Walter and his influence on how we sing the hymns in terms of the types of tunes and the speed of the tunes. All of this was very important. It was kind of under development in the late 19th century. You had all of these Germanic immigrants coming from different areas in Germany. Remember, Germany wasn't even a country until the 1870s. They were coming from all of these different principalities. They had different ways of singing different meters. So the poor church musician, the cantor, the teacher, had to deal with probably multiple hymnals being used by their people, maybe different traditions. By the late 19th century, hopefully most LCMS churches had Walter's hymnal, so maybe that wasn't so much an issue. But I know it was like here in Texas, in Serbin, they were using several immigrant hymnals at the time, which is made very complicated to sing one tune to multiple metrical settings of the text. So that was just another complexity that the Addison Seminary taught its graduates how to maneuver. And I should say, as we conclude, the Addison Seminary moved then to River Forest, a few miles north, in 1913 or so, and became the River Forest Concordia Chicago that we know now. And of course, into the 20th century, this is a little bit beyond where I go, but you think of all the great musical liturgical tradition that comes from Concordia River Forest and then Chicago. You had Carl Schalk, you had Richard Hillert. If you don't know Richard Hillert's name, you know his "This is the Feast of Victory of Our God" from Divine Service 1. I'm actually writing Hillert's biography right now. Quite exciting. So Concordia Chicago continued this teaching, this pedagogy of church musicians and parochial school teachers to the present day.
Yeah, tell us more about that history. We have about 2 minutes left, but tell us more about how those efforts of the men at Addison and then into present day now Concordia Chicago, how that really has helped solidify the teaching of sacred music in our LCMS heritage and culture.
Well, I think one of the ways they did this was by having essentially everybody learn keyboard. And in the 20th century, this was true for all of the Concordias. whether it was Seward, Chicago, Wisconsin, Austin, everybody, all the teachers had to learn how to play organ. And it was just expected that you would become the parish musician, the organist. And this was true well into the, I mean, I suppose it's true now, but I don't think that keyboard component is required in the same way it was. But back then, it seemed that the organist was the chief musician. You had to do a lot more than play the organ, but you had to start there. So these men of the 20th century, Carl Schalk and Hillert and Carlos Messerly, they made it a part of their pedagogy to make sure that everybody had good keyboard training. An extension of that was vocal training. You know, you had to learn how to conduct a choir. And so you have a great choral tradition, particularly coming out of Concordia River Forest, and a band tradition, although that came much later. That wasn't the direct descendant of Addison pedagogy. But you have this spectacular tradition of church music and music in general coming from Concordia, Chicago.
All right, so we've talked a little bit about sacred music pedagogy. What else are we going to look at in upcoming episodes as we talk about portraits in American Lutheran sacred music?
Well, I would like to talk about the vocation of the church musician, because this, it wasn't the focus of the book, but it became clear to me early on that these musicians viewed themselves, their vocation. You know, how do they live in the world? How are they a witness to Christ? They did it in a very similar way, and it's not very different from modern church musicians. Even though we have email and computer and internet and all that, we kind of have the same vocation. Very little has changed, and I find that an interesting concept to explore. So we'll talk a bit more about that.
Very good. We'll learn more as we continue our series next week with Benjamin Colucci, taking a look at Portraits in American Lutheran Sacred Music, 1847-1947, from Concordia Publishing House. You can find it at cph.org. Benjamin, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. I am excited about the rest of this series as well. Thanks for being our guest today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.